So what I want to look at with you today is the impact of municipal reforms in Quebec, looking more specifically, focusing on Montreal. We've been talking about the Montreal metropolitan area since the beginning of the day, but I suggest to look at it from another point of view, which is what happened in way of legal fights, legal conflicts in the process of mergers and demergers in Montreal. So that's why I titled it What Happens When Institutional Space Gets Reshuffled, because that was the whole idea of the municipal reform. Okay, for those of you who are not that familiar with Montreal or Quebec, let me quickly go over what's happened in Montreal. First of all, Montreal Island, up to 2002, actually, was divided into 28 different municipalities, 28 cities only on the island of Montreal. And over that, there was a metropolitan area, which was called the Montreal Urban Community, which was enacted in 69, came into force in 70. So that was the situation. Now, I did a study of that institutional situation, actually just before the reform started, looking at the history of local taxation in Quebec with a focus on Montreal area. And what I present here, and I'm sorry if it's a bit, let me explain to you what it is here. You have the name of not all 28 municipalities, but a good portion of it, which you find Ville-Saint-Pierre, Montreal, Anjou, and so on. And on the vertical axis, you have here the average revenue of household. What you can see is that, on the l'axe des Y, you find the tax rate. So you can see the tax rate in Montreal would go from about $1 per $100 valuation to about just over two, so from one to double, whether you lived in one or the other city on the same very island where everybody more or less comes to work downtown Montreal. So, and you can see that what you have on the X axis is the average revenue per household. So there, it goes from about $40,000 to $175,000. So you can see the spread of revenue. You can also see that average revenue varies a lot from one city to the other. And the other thing that you notice is that the wealthier you are, the lower is your tax rate. Now, so that's revenue. And of course, you know, taxation, you mentioned it this morning, taxation at the municipal level is not based on revenue, but based on real estate value. So I did the same thing with the average value of a house. And we find the same pattern. That is, the best house you have, the lower is your taxation rate. So I think it's important to know that this was the situation on the island of Montreal before the reforms. One can translate that into different things. You've mentioned de facto gated community. That's part of the pattern, isn't it? Now, another dimension that we must know to understand the different phenomenon is the role that municipalities play in way of tax of perception, I'm talking about perception fiscale. The point is that municipalities in Quebec, the situation has evolved a lot over the last century, but the Quebec policy, and actually we find the same thing across Canada, is that municipalities are more or less autonomous. That is, that municipalities do raise on their own territory about 90% of their revenues. So that's the line in purple is the schools. So schools are not in the same situation as opposed to decision in the states, because most of the financing for schools come from the central government, which is Quebec government, and municipalities provide only 15%, which is not the case at the municipal level. So it's very important to know those structural elements to understand what's happening at the city level. So, and of course, you understand that the there is a consequence for this financial autonomy of municipality, and the kind of segregation that we saw through the municipal borders, and that is that you have a very wide tax rate disparities across urban areas. So it is within that context that Quebec underwent a major municipal reform starting at the beginning of 2000. Reform which, because of change of government, which happened during that time, was made in two steps. The first step was to recommend and do mergers of cities. I'm going to go fast here, but the point is that for Montreal, the policy of one island, one city was enacted, which means that all those 28 municipalities in Montreal were merged in one big municipality. So on the 1st of January 2002, Big Montreal came into life. So you can see here, this is drawn from the report that preceded the reform. You can see the island of Montreal in the southern part, the one with the colors, and you can see the borders of the different 28 municipalities. And I would like to draw your attention right now, because I'm going to speak to you about one of those municipalities, which is located right here, Senneville, because it's a nice example of what's the kind of reaction that the merger created. So the merger was not well received from certain section of the population, as you can understand. After the mergers were done, we went into elections, provincial elections in that case, and the opposing party suggested or made the promise to allow demergers if they were elected. And they were elected on the 14th of April 2003, and then they enacted a demerger process, which took place, and which means that on the 1st of January 2006, new councils of new demerged cities and the remnants of the city of Montreal came into force. The particularity for Montreal Island is that 15 of the 28 previous municipalities decided or voted in a referendum process to demerge. So you can see that it just burst into pieces, not as many, we didn't come back to 28, but 15 plus Montreal, which means 16. So we went from 28 municipalities to one, and now back to 16. You can imagine what it means in way of institutional restructuring, reshuffling. It's a major thing. The city of Montreal and the agglomeration of Montreal still has not recovered from it, but we won't go into that. So my question was, what do I see in the court conflicts, court decisions, as an outcome of that process? In other words, on what basis and whom took someone to court to fight either the merger or in the process of demergers. So as I mentioned, I thought there wouldn't be that much. Well, I have a pile. I just did the research in the data bank, you know, the legal decisions data bank, and I have a pile that high on my desk, of which I probably went through about a third of it. I haven't gone through it all, but I tried to pick, you know, the most meaningful ones, and what I intend to do is to show you some aspects of it. But I thought sometimes, you know, a good caricature explains things, right? So the interesting thing is that I found a case which seems like a caricature, but actually it's a real case. So I thought I'd share it with you. So I showed to you this village of Saint-Ville on the island of Montreal, which is a small village. Actually, it's a municipality de village, which represents 930 residents. That's about 350 households. So you can see it's a kind of a small community. And people think of Westmount as the rich, everybody knows Westmount as the rich section of Montreal. Forget about it. It is Saint-Ville by far, but not too many people knew about it because there are not that many people there. But so the average household is revenue is 135 compared to 42 for Montreal. The real estate residential value per capita is 126,000 compared to about 30,000 for Montreal. So you can see that we're talking about a particular municipality. So how did Saint-Ville react to the reform? Well, there was, in November of 2000, came the first reading of Bill 170, which was the merger bill, the bill that enacted the mergers of all cities on the island. Just as you can see, a few weeks after, the mayor of Saint-Ville, with two councillors, created an association, which was called the Association of the Friends of Saint-Ville, which could take decisions based on two people. The quorum was two members, the mayor and one councillor, and of course there was no public notice before the meetings. What were the agreement between the city and this association is what we're going to find out. So again, you see very fast, you see 5th of December, the following week, the motions adopted by the village of Saint-Ville, by which the village transferred $1 million to the association, which was a surplus that they had, you know, some money set aside, and they didn't want the city, the big city of Montreal, to lay their hands on that and maybe, you know, share it with other people. So this was transferred to the association. And they signed a contract by which the city hall and the municipal garage, which were the big infrastructure of the city, were transferred to the association in exchange of $140,000, which was, of course, paid by the grant of $1 million. And of course, you know, the association leased these equipment, the city hall, to the municipality. And then they adopted, they enacted other motions by which all other equipment of the municipality were transferred to this Association of Friends of Saint-Ville for very little money, the book value, as the mayor explained, you know, to the judge before the court. So this, you can imagine, went to court. The Attorney General of Quebec contested the validity, the legality of these motions. Then I quote what the justice says. On réalise à quel point l'association a usurpé l'autorité légitime de l'entité municipale. Of course, these actions were illegal. They represented abus de pouvoir, irrégularité grave. They're contrary to the Civil Code of Quebec, which says no one may acquire for himself property of legal persons established in the public interest that is appropriated to public utility. And it was also contrary to Section 28 of the Towns and Cities Act of Quebec. So actions by the municipality to divert and set aside public property to protect it from the big city that was coming and could lay their hands on things. So that is, you know, the one example, I think, which represents, which gives us an idea about things that happened, things that occurred. This is the worst that I've seen, let me say it, you know. But it tells us something about the spirit into with which this reform to try and correct some fiscal inequity were responded to. So when I look at all my cases, I can categorize them into three categories. First of all, there were protests about the merger and the demerger processes themselves. There were a lot of conflicts on the financial impact of mergers and demergers. We're talking here about sharing public revenue. How is the municipality going to be used and misused to share public revenue and provide services to the citizenry? And there are also quite a few conflicts about labor, of which I'm not going to say anything. If I quickly tell you some few things about the merger-demerger process, how can we categorize those? Well, first of all, there were a lot of fights to try and stop the mergers, try and get the government, take an injunction and ask the court to say the government has no right to touch my little municipality, my little gated, de facto gated community. There were a lot in Montreal, but not only in Montreal. I mentioned here something about the Chicoutimi area as well. Lebby tried to fight that. And some of those cases, they tried to go all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. You don't have a de facto right to go to the Supreme Court of Canada. You must ask for the permission to go to the Supreme Court. So some of those stopped at that point. So once the merger, people tried to stop the merger, they lost, in court. And then once we went into the demergers, then it's interesting because then it's the other way around. People are going to court to try and push the demergers when it didn't work, when rules established by the law did not get, to that point. To tell you quickly, for instance, this went through a process of referendum. There were rules enacted that said, okay, we're going to accept that you demerge, but you have to convince us that you really want that, and a good portion of your population wants that, and therefore, we're going to ask not only that a majority of yes for demerger goes, but that at least 35% of people on the voting list do vote yes. And some municipalities just missed it, For instance, L'Île Bizarre here in Montreal, they got 33% of the population. And therefore, they tried to contest the process, saying something went wrong. They should have had the permission to demerge. The second, and I'll finish on that because after that, there's not too much, was the financial and fiscal impacts of the demergers. It's very interesting because I've participated to a lot of debate in those years, and of course, people would say, well, of course we're willing to pay our taxes like everybody, but we want to keep our small towns, we want to keep our small cities. But when it comes to the real situation, and you look at what's happened and how people do contribute either to the supra-municipal organization and so on, then there are bitter fights. And that's what we see happening. For instance, you understand that when you merge many cities into one town, the principle is that everybody in the same town should pay the same tax rate. And therefore, if some people have the advantage of a lower tax, their tax rate should increase. But the law said, we're not going to increase more than 5% a year. We're going to go slowly so that you don't get scared. And then, so there were fights on that. You see, you did increase us more than 5%, depending on how, of course, you calculate this and all that. So a lot of fights on that in the Longueuil area, in Montreal area. And protests from the federal government as well for equipment like La Tour de Radio-Canada, ou l'administration portuaire de Montréal, for which their tax rate increased following the merger, and they protested on that. And that went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they lost also. And also, and I'll finish with that, we see claims in between cities that are now within the agglomeration of Montreal. And in that case, it's not the poor suing the rich, it's the rich suing the poor, claiming for more money. So in this case, Westmount is claiming over $20 million from the city of Montreal for things that happened during the merger and in the demerger process. Okay, so I'll just, merci.
I was just thinking, I just wanted your opinion on what ways you think reform could have gone differently that would have preempted these problems. Because what I've seen too identified, and having myself voted in a demerger, having myself, you know, been part of this community, and I identify like a fundamental tension between fiscal inequity, but at the same time, like, there's different needs within the municipality depending on the population. So, for example, I grew up in Côte Saint-Luc, and the population happens to be 85% seniors, and there's a need for a first responder service. And so that municipality was specifically upset that they wouldn't be able to have their concerns, you know, to fund that service to its municipality because of the demerger. So I agree, of course, there's these two, you know, tensions, and just your opinion on how reform could have sort of reconciliated these two.
Well, I think at one point, first of all, it's true that our local governments is the level of government that should attend to those local needs, as you describe. And all municipalities, you know, should be able to respond to that, whether they're big or small. Now, the point is that we also have to recognize that on certain issues, we'll never agree. And when we talk about taxation, we really hit a hard one, because we all would prefer to pay less, you know, lesser taxes. Voluntary taxation doesn't work, right? So the question is, how do you organize it so that the distribution of taxation is fair? When I look at a same urban system, which is, and especially in Montreal, you see, it's particularly interesting because many of those municipalities were actually enclave within Montreal. They're all surrounded, you know, by Montreal. It's difficult to claim, you know, on the local or the localist theory, you know, in political science, that these are autonomous and therefore, you know, they should, because anyhow, they only go to sleep there, right? They consume more water, you know, outside of the borders. They throw their garbage outside of the border. They use the hospitals and the universities and everything outside of the borders. So you understand that the claim to say that we're allowed to have our own town is a bit of a joke in the way, or it's a strategy, right? And it's interesting to look at the language and the discourse, actually, which in court was being used. Because nobody can go to court and say, I claim the right to pay fewer taxes or lower tax rate than my neighbor, although I live in the same urban fabric. Nobody can say that, right? So what do you say? Well, you find other things to say. You still find things. And of course, you know, it's interesting to look at the discourse. I went through the testimonies that were presented, you know, before the court for the fight on Bill 170, and we find disturbing things, actually. And it boiled down, actually, that it came to the question of language in Montreal, right? So most of the cities said, you know, we are mainly Anglophones, and therefore, and the municipal government is the only level of government in Quebec where Anglophones could sometimes have the majority, right? Well, that's calling for ethnic or linguistic governments. I'm sorry, this does not exist, right? It does not exist in Quebec. It does not exist in the rest of Canada. It does not exist in the States. Even the Inuit, you know, in northern Quebec don't have that. And if one community could claim, you know, this sort of thing. And furthermore, it became obvious that it was just rhetoric, because all the municipalities that claim this right to represent the Anglophone together had 10 times less Anglophone than the old Montreal. So the justice said, well, okay, I'm interpreting, of course, you know, he says, do you tell me that there are kind of the Anglophones and the second class Anglophones of Quebec, you know, the Anglophones, you know, entitled to their own cities where they're majority, and the second class one, you know, they can go into the big city of Montreal. So I think we have to be careful when we look at discourse and we look at rhetorics and we look at arguments as to what is behind it. What is the real argument? The real argument, in my view, beyond identity and, you know, patrimonial attachment and all this, you know, that was really a taxation argument because of the way that, because somebody mentioned it also today, municipalities are mainly financed by real estate tax, and therefore, if you can concentrate high real estate value, I mean, you have a paradis fiscal, tax heaven, so, you know. And structurally, that's what Montreal represented. Of course, you know, not too many people can say that like that. And I, again, you know, I understand this kind of attachment, identity and all that, and I support that, but not for the wrong reasons, you know, and therefore it's important, you know, to bring that out.
Thank you for the paper. It was really fascinating, and for me really highlighted like the contrast in the two systems of local government law, because like my understanding through the work by like Jerry Frug and Richard Briefaux is that the structure of local government law in the U.S. has shifted so dramatically over the course of the 20th century that cities or municipalities have the power to incorporate and to resist any kind of coercive mergers or annexations. So the contrast is really interesting. What I was thinking about when you were talking, and I'm kind of curious to hear what you think about this, my intuitions line up with yours exactly, really. But I was thinking about an argument that Stephen Macedo made that I initially was very, very skeptical about, but your argument made me think, well, maybe there was something to it. And he was talking about the U.S., where the issue is very strongly schooling. It's very important. And so there's that difference, but I think otherwise it's exactly the same. And he was making an argument that was very much in line with yours. However, he said that, now of course, if you buy a house in one of these de facto gated communities, you pay a premium to get into it. The house costs more because of the benefits. So in the US, it costs more because you're buying this education for your children. I think in your case, you're buying a lower tax rate. And what he said was, this move should be made, but we are effectively changing the rules of the game after people have paid a premium to buy into these communities, and they ought to be compensated when we change the rules of the game. And I was initially very skeptical. However, listening to your case study and your paper, I thought maybe there is something to that, not just for pragmatic reasons, because it probably would have made things go more smoothly, but also because we're making a transition from a less just to a more just scenario on the backs of some but not all individuals. And even though these are privileged individuals, they are, I think, disproportionately bearing the burden of the transition. So initially I thought he was wrong, but really when I think about your case, I think maybe there is an argument. So surely there are wealthy people who don't live in those small communities who aren't paying the same cost for the transition. And so should the people in the de facto gated communities who bought with the expectation that their communities would remain stable receive some compensation, both for pragmatic and maybe for ethical reasons?
I think you should stay skeptical. I don't know Macedo, but I'll tell you why. I think there's a major flaw to his argument, which is it's not true that they're buying a premium. They're making an investment. and the increased value of their house stays with them. They get, you know, houses in those communities, you know, they gain more value than the poor house that you purchase, you know, in the
But won't that change area? with the merger? So in other words, once their tax rate rises, like if the market functions, the value should decrease.
Well, that's what I'm not an economist. I understand that, you know, the economists would say that, you know, because therefore now you'll have more taxes to pay, so the demand will lower and therefore the value. The experience in Montreal doesn't show that, you know, the value has not decreased.
But it seems it was such a short period of time. It was only a few months before they demerged, right?
They demerged to a certain extent. I didn't go into all the details, you know. It was not full demerger because, of course, you know, once the demerger was allowed, you still needed this metropolitan municipal authority. We were not going to go back to previous 1969. So therefore, it was created the Agglomération de Montréal. And now the average is that about 50% of the tax raised in all municipalities goes to Montreal for services provided to the whole area. But again, you know, it's not. That's right, for proximity services, for local services. So, but beware of this characterization as premium, you know, paying a premium, you know, for that. They're making an investment. And there's another thing as well, you know. Real estate tax is a tax on wealth. Of course, you know, we have other dimensions to wealth. Now, it used to be, you know, that real estate was the wealth, you know, that people would hold. It's no more the case, but at least it's one. We don't have any other type of wealth taxes in Canada. There is no more succession taxes. There used to be that this was abolished. The only part that remains is a tax sur le capital, on capital for, but this is, you know, Stephen Harper now is going to do the rest of the job, you know, not much will be left to that. So the real estate tax is the only wealth tax. And with the pattern that I showed you, you know, we understand that for tax on revenue, the progressive tax rate, although it's less progressive, you know, also in the States and in Canada, but with the wealth tax, the only one we have is municipal taxes, and it's inversement proportionnel à la richesse.
So, I was completely on board with the mergers on the issue of, on the principle of, you know, and your data just, you know, highlights it. But, you know, the beef that was made, and this is perhaps getting very parochial for our guests, but you know, the one of the complaints that was made about the premier who basically announced the mergers was that he did it in a very high-handed manner. So it was announced in a very, to use some of the terms that have come up in the course of the day here, a very non-deliberative kind of manner. He announced one morning that there was going to be these demergers and, you know, like it or leave it. So I think that there's perhaps, this is going to be a very weak devil's advocate, maybe not the devil, more like one of those, you know, little guys who hangs around by your ear while the angel is talking on the other side. So, you know, I think that at the very least, there is a consideration to be given for a value on the other side of the ledger, which does have to do with community. And here I think that there's something that we have to be very wary about. At various points you said in your argument, the real reason that they wanted was to do with taxes. Now, I think that for a lot of people that's true, but I think that for a lot of people it probably isn't. My mother-in-law, who is a British woman down to her marrow, yeah, jusqu'à la moelle, came to Montreal in 1973, moved to Westmount, and basically there's some kind of radar when she leaves the city limits. There's no visible thing. You know, she starts getting hives and nervous. You know, there really is an attachment to the community of Westmount, to certain landmarks. She goes to all the activities, the things at Westmount City Hall. I mean, I am convinced that for her and for a lot of people like her, it is not really a question of, but you know, she was a small town lady from a small town in England. Her husband, this is getting very biographical, but you know, I'm sure that there are people. Her husband worked in London, and in order to be able to stay in a small town, he commuted 2 hours into London every day back and forth, so that the kids could be raised in a small town. She wants to recreate the small town atmosphere, and to a large degree, she does. Now, in political philosophy, we have this idea of expensive taste. So she has an expensive taste. She wants to be able to live in a small town that's also kind of well, you know, serviced and everything like that, and that has a lot of benefits. And at the end of the day, we want to be able to say to her, look, we understand, you know, your preference for this kind of way of life, but look at the bigger picture and see how what costs it imposes on others, and what, you know, the lack of sort of solidarity I guess the point I'm making is, A, we have to be sort of aware of the fact that there is something like, for a lot of people, a longing for a smaller community in the context of a big city. There's something anomic about a big city that you may want to resist. And B, an obligation, I think, on the part of the people who are making the justice-based argument to be perhaps more respectful of the reasons that others might have. Because I think we got into a dynamic which was both problematic from the ethical point of view, but also, you know, if you question my motives, I'll start questioning your motives, and we're on a slippery slope down to hell, and to the courts, actually, which is maybe the same thing. And so this is a mishmash of considerations, which probably don't, at the end of the day, I still think that it was and is the right thing to do, but I think that there are ways of doing it, and there's a certain kind of ear and voice that you have to the claims of the others that perhaps were lacking in the actual way in which it was done by the government at the time. I'm not sure if they'd done it in a different way, it would have given rise to a different result, but maybe we should have tried a bit harder.
Merci, Daniel, pour ces commentaires. Il y a deux dimensions à ton argument. Il y a d'abord celui, la terminologie qui a été reprise ad nauseam, de fusion forcée. Hein, c'était des fusions forcées par opposition à des fusions volontaires. Et évidemment, ce que tu rapportes, c'est beaucoup ce qui a été rapporté dans les médias et tout ça, à savoir que c'est arrivé tout d'un coup, d'une façon un peu improvisée, sans préparation et tout ça. Je ne mentionnerai pas qu'il y a déjà eu un livre décrit en 1940 par le rédacteur en chef de la presse qui proposait une île, une ville. Mais bref, je pense que c'est une vision particulière des choses. Il y a eu une commission nationale sur les finances et la fiscalité locale qui a siégé pendant 2 ans avant. Il y a eu un rapport. Il y a eu de nombreux rapports, de nombreuses discussions, mais personne ne croyait qu'un gouvernement allait avoir le courage de le faire. Et donc, évidemment, quand c'est arrivé comme un grand choc. Very interesting, actually, because, you know, I don't think we have seen in Quebec big demonstrations like the opposition to mergers. I mean, it was really an event. I mean, it takes a lot for people to get out on the street and demonstrate, especially in those type of suburbs, right? But they did, right? So, pour la dimension fusion forcée, je pense qu'on peut présenter une image différente. Maintenant, ta tante, je suis sûre que ta belle-mère, faut que je fasse attention encore plus. Of course, you know, there are many people who, and truly, they have no idea anyhow about this bigger picture, you know, and the impact on their tax and all that, you know. So of course they're honestly attached to their hometown, and this, you know, is to be respected. It's important, you know, for local life and all that. But with all my due respect, this is anecdotal, right? I can tell anecdotes too, you know, from other. What counts, c'est la théorie des grands nombres, hein? What the system leads like, and of course, you know. The elite who pursue, you know, that they use those anecdotes and they use, you know, this kind of logic. So, but you're not going to fall into that. Yeah.
I just had some quick factual questions. The first is, if you could just say a little bit about how you got 28 municipalities here in the first place. That is the background, which is, in the United States, what you saw is an explosion in incorporations in response to annexation threats. And I don't know if Montreal had the power to annex, and then the peak of that happened in about the 1950s. It actually ends earlier than some have thought. David Barron at Harvard has done some work on this. In 1970, annexation powers are taken away from cities, essentially. The western cities still have some of them. but also incorporation powers start to, the incorporations drop off quite dramatically after 1970 in the United States. So I'm just wondering how you got 28 municipalities, if there were fights about that in the first place. And then the second thing is, I'm surprised over the vehemence of this, because over the vehemence of the fight, yeah, sorry, vehemence of the, that's the best I can do. because as Clarissa said, usually in the United States it's over school spending, but school spending's taken out of the equation, it appears. It also sounded like you said that 50% of the tax raised locally goes to the central entity anyway.
Now
at the post.
Yeah.
So there's revenue sharing now of a significant portion, which seems not to have... people, I guess, are still upset, but they don't seem to be that. There doesn't seem to be much, unless there is fights to get some of that back. And then I'm wondering, just again, as an informational matter, why the 13 who didn't demerge didn't, aside from the ones that didn't receive, didn't get above the 35%. You understand what I'm saying? So some people decided to stay in after being absorbed. Why did they decide to stay in?
They're all very good questions. The first one, how did we get to 28 different municipalities on the island of Montreal? Back before urbanization and industrialization, it was simple. There was the city of Montreal and the parish of Montreal. So the city of Montreal within the walls, that's old Montreal, more or less. Et puis tout le reste, c'était la paroisse, la municipalité de la paroisse de Montréal. So it was fields, right? With urbanization and industrialization, there came, you know, different interests, you know, being built and located across the territory. And once you do that, well, it's always the same logic, right? You want to keep, you know, the benefits to a community, to a, what you define as a community. So territories started to be detached from the paroisse de Montréal. It was incorporated. It was a municipality of the parish, okay? But once you create, there were, it was not only a question of tax. I mean, I know I have this fixation, but it's also a question of empowerment, right? Because if you want to create a city, then according to the law, you get more powers, so you needed to, you know, to provide for all kinds of services, you know, public transportation, roads, sewage and all that, you know. So these territories were detached because, you know, you provide the water system, not in the fields, but only in the urban area. So this came, you know, with the process. But there's been research done for the way it developed in Montreal. And for instance, you can see the way that the actual population is being segregated according to the way the activities are, for instance, where the industries are being set. So along the Canal de la Chine, or if you look at Maisonneuve, which is now one of the poorest area, used to be the biggest industrial town in Canada at one time. And the interesting thing that we see there is that the industrialists, you know, who set up those towns, like Maisonneuve is a good example, or Saint-Henri along the canal. So they set up their industries there because Montreal was the capital, industrial capital of Canada at that time. So they set up their industries. They more or less control the city council, you know, for being the elite, of course. So they get the council to get to give them tax breaks for the industries. And they go and set up their home, their residence in those bourgeois cities, which is Outremont and Westmount, where by enacting bylaws that says if you want to build in Westmount, you've got to have land of minimum of so much acres, and your house got to have a value of at least this. So of course you exclude all the poor people, and you make sure that you have this concentration of wealth. And therefore, although the tax is raised on wealth, if you get a, you know, that's communism, right? You get a lot of rich people together. They don't pay that much because they're all amongst themselves, right? And whereas these people set up there, at the same time, you have the industries, you know, getting tax breaks. The workers at that time needed to live close by to the industry because that was before the subway and all that, right? So, and therefore they bear the tax rate and all that. So you have this kind of, that's at the time when the land was broken up in all these cities. And of course there were municipalities that went bankrupt because they just couldn't bear it anymore, and therefore they were annexed to the city of Montreal. Maisonneuve was a good example. It had a huge debt. Montreal didn't want to take it, but the government forced the city of Montreal to absorb Maisonneuve and absorb the debt and all that, you know, whereas the, so, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with the pattern, but that's what is very much the case on the island of Montreal. So, and of course, it helps to understand that, to understand or to interpret the reform, the latest reform of 2000. Okay, so that was your first question. The second one, the vehemence of it, or the way, well, it's true. You're right to be surprised. You know, we think it's natural because it happened, but you're right. Let's say that municipalities do raise about 10% of all taxes being raised on the territory. That is including the federal government and the provincial government. So it is meaningful. And when you have we have a house in those, it is meaningful, and therefore people are willing to fight for it. And your third question, I just wrote, why? I forget what it was.
Why did the 13s decide not to?
That's interesting, because some colleagues at UQAM wrote something, and I did a research with one of my ex-students at McGill on that. And in Montreal, it's interesting because we can, with the exception of one of municipality who decided to demerge, you need the convergence of two factors to explain who would demerge. And actually, you know, with that, you could have guessed which municipalities would demerge. And the two factors are, first, wealth, concentrated wealth. So it's your objective interest not to be part of a bigger entity because you're going to pay for the others, right? So that's the first thing. The second thing, but then if there was only that, there are certain situations that couldn't be explained, like Outremont, for instance, which is the Francophone bourgeois municipality. Outremont decided not to demerge. Therefore, that's why I say you needed two factors, wealth and Anglophone. And that's what it is, with the exception of Montréal Est, which is in the eastern part of Montreal, where wealth exists, but it's based on something else. It's not residential wealth, it's industrial wealth. That's where the refineries are. And therefore, the tax rate was much lower, and it's very mixed, ethnically very mixed background, but certainly couldn't label it as Anglophone. So that's the one exception.
Great. So there's sort of an interesting connection between your presentation and the previous presentation. So I think you might be surprised to think about Lefebvre in the context of, you know, Montreal municipal law, but there's there's actually a connection, right? So have you? Yeah. You haven't read Lefebvre. Oh, right. Right. So the way the constitutional claim was framed was about participation in city life, essentially, in city governance, right? And so, you know, when I heard your presentation, I thought, sort of much like Daniel, that seems like kind of a crazy argument. But it's not actually that crazy, because there are other forms of rights claims that you can make that are like this, right? It's about participation and the public and the group goods that come from participation. So in the Canadian constitutional context, language rights to education are these kinds of rights. They're participatory goods, right? And so I just thought sort of an interesting overlap between the two presentations. Interestingly, the way it was framed in the constitutional case that was denied leave was as an equality rights claim. And I just want to sort of test your intuition, Médicloude. So the claim was they're being treated unequally because of their language, right? And so the claim was there's a constitutional right based on this characteristic, which is essential, immutable, right? It seems to me that actually the stronger claim, and this is what I wanted to test your intuition about, the stronger claim actually comes the other way. That is, there are groups and neighborhoods in all across Canada which are ethnically concentrated and disadvantaged, right? Not by fusions, not by mergers, but by the simple fact of the municipal law system, right? Of the way the taxation system works. So just as a kind of test of sort of see where your intuition lies, right? It seems to me that's a much stronger constitutional law argument, right? That is, if you are a racial minority and you are concentrated in a neighborhood that is persistently disadvantaging you, right? That seems to me far more of a more valid constitutional claim, and it seems to have a more robust conception of equality that would support it.
The way you would translate it in law, you would say discriminatory, right? Discrimination. There was a fight for the mega Toronto, as you probably know, right? But the argument was based on the fact that the poorer area of Toronto would have less access to their municipal council because they were bigger boroughs as opposed to the wealthier area. And this was rejected, as you can understand, because, I mean, Canada couldn't exist, you know, if we wouldn't accept that, you know, because we wouldn't have any MPs, you know, all MPs would be in Montreal and the rest would have, you know, nothing. But you're right, the case made in the Montreal and there were case was based on language, actually, saying that, you know, we're being treated, you know, from a discriminatory place, which, as I explained, you know, didn't stand. But your point is, can somebody claim discrimination because they do pay a different tax rate? Well, sorry, but it's the basis of taxation that we can discriminate populations, that we can, you know, impose a higher rate or a lower rate to people. So you cannot make, I believe, in law, or at least if you have a way out of that, I'm glad we don't have a way out of that. It is the basis of taxation that, you know, some people are exempted, you know, for certain things. Taxation wouldn't work otherwise. So I'm afraid you couldn't go very far with that.
Hello? Okay. So I was fully satisfied with your answer. I just want to make sure that I correctly understand. I believe you that you look at the rhetoric and that there's truth, that it did come down to other disputes that stem, you know, as you said, between language, and you went over that. And at the end of the day, we have to make, you know, a cost-benefit analysis between that feeling, you know, as Daniel was talking about, the community feeling, and then justice. And at the end of the day, what is it, you know, that's more important? So my question goes back to your first comment, to the example that I gave you with the municipality with the 85% population of seniors who, you know, may require an ambulance to be there within 3 minutes in ways that the rest of the municipalities don't require that because, you know, there's a higher rate of cardiac arrest within that municipality, for example. And you said that, correct me if I'm wrong, you said that it shouldn't matter, that the service should be provided. So do you think that the issue of, and you talked about institutional deshuffling and the city merging and demerging, do you think that that is sort of a response to problems in policy and problems of inadequacy of services, and that the way in which it was expressed, I know this is a bit philosophical, but the way in which it was expressed exploded within this sort of way, the conflict between the demerger and merger of Montreal? I know this is a very specific question to Montreal particularly, and Quebec policymaking and the healthcare system. I've studied a little bit about the healthcare system, so that's why I'm asking. I just wanted your opinion.
I did say that services, you know, should be provided, you know, to people when it's, of course, you know, reasonable. As somebody mentioned this morning, we're not going to provide services that don't make sense. But I think we have to look at the role of municipalities in a wider context, you know, today, because there's a lot of pressure, you know, on municipalities to provide things that actually they're not well designed to do. You mentioned healthcare. Well, that's one example where municipalities are faced with problems, and if the services are not well provided, you know, by the provincial government, municipalities feel kind of they have a duty to, I mean, homeless people, for instance, you know, I mean, this is an issue which is not listed as a major, you know, as a that falls into the domain of municipalities. And yet, you know, today big cities have to handle these problems. Think of the insight issue, you know, in Vancouver, where municipalities, the city of Vancouver and Montreal wants to set up these supervised drug injection sites for citizens, which again is something new, you know, for municipalities. But then Harper decided to close it, and the Supreme Court is hearing this case. It's going to be a very interesting case, you know, in the distribution of power between the federal government, the provincial government, and the cities, you see. So, of course, you know, for the citizen, you know, as a citizen within a municipality, we have kind of a short view, and the municipality seems more accessible, and we ask things, you know, from our municipalities, which maybe they're not the ones to provide that, right? And it creates all kinds of tension, which people do, you know, fight out, but we have to kind of back up a bit and ask ourselves, you know, these questions. I just wrote a paper on the role of municipalities in healthcare with the setup of health co-ops across the province, where this is not an urban phenomenon, it's more of a rural phenomenon, because, you know, physicians don't want to go, you know, and work, you know, in these faraway areas, as you mentioned. And so what's happened, you know, municipalities, you know, far away, many municipalities have elders. And it's interesting, you know, these faraway municipalities say, well, first of all, we lost all our youngsters leaving, you know, for the big cities, you know, that's where they get jobs and all that. So you're left with an elderly population in the countryside. But now this elderly population don't have access to good health care, so they're going to lose them as well. So they say, well, we have to act, we have to do something. And they set up, you know, co-ops, which create another type of legal problems, in my view, you see. So these are complex issues, and you know, and of course, you know, people get very sentimental and very upset and very vehement, you know, about these issues as well. But it does raise the bigger picture of the distribution of power, you know, between different levels of government, which is because the society is changing, we cannot think of our public administration or our different levels of government as being, you know, set and not being able to move. So these pressures are really acting, and it's people who bear the brunt of that.
Just quickly, I you know, the Toronto perspective, you mentioned it. Two points. One is, I guess, the issue of revanchism, which comes into this debate. Revanchism is which is in the Neil Smith sense, not in the military sense, in the sense of already privileged people taking advantage of a situation like that and then actually building on that privilege and going after the poor and the homeless. And so it's not just a regular exclusion by those wonderful processes, you so wonderfully explained, of the bosses having their factories built here and moving up there. So this is sort of the regular way in which segregation and class intermingle, and Laura Pulido in the United States has shown that for race also, that racism is not just the siding of one particular incinerator in a particular neighborhood, but it's the whole system that involves race and class in these systematic manners. But in the Montreal, in the Toronto amalgamation, it just so happened that this idea of revanchism came on top of all this, because there was a rabidly and incredibly aggressive neoliberal government at the provincial level, which attempted to penalize people. I mean, the first thing they did after they were elected was to cut welfare by 20%. And so there was an intention there, which was mingled with the rationalities of that tax reform. So there were various processes going on. So the point here, that I don't know whether it's the same in Montreal, but in Toronto, very clearly the case, is this slippage of different discourses. So that is your mother-in-law. That was also in Toronto, because all the churches were full with old white people claiming that their city was being destroyed by the suburban hordes. They were well-meaning people, but they were also very elitist. And that discourse slipped into another discourse on social and spatial justice, and into a discourse of educational reform. And so all of these things were happening at the same time. So it was difficult to say what in the end won the political game as these things happened at the same time. And I want to say that it's markedly different from the United States and the history of annexation in the United States. Because if you look at, for example, the way Los Angeles has been structured over time, and then in 10 years ago when movements in the San Fernando Valley and San Pedro, for example, attempted to split from the city, the arguments made were entirely different, and the articulations made were entirely different than the ones in Toronto and in Montreal. Except they were actually exactly upside down, as the neoliberals, neoconservatives in Toronto used arguments for amalgamation, the same politically, ideologically minded people in Los Angeles used a localist argument like the people here to say we want to split from the city of LA. So it's what I'm saying is context is important, and this idea of slippage of one discourse into another.
Thank you for that. I totally agree. And there's another dimension that adds up to that when we compare Ontario to Quebec, for instance, you know, with the big mergers in Ontario. Added to that was the downloading of social services to the municipalities, like social old age housing, and which did not happen in Quebec. Not yet, right? So, because of course, you know, when you create a structure that is more robust for, you create a more robust governance or institutional structure at one level, the municipal level, you can use it for different means, right? You can use it for a better redistribution, but you can use it for bad means as well, right? And therefore, one has to be always careful about that. And as you very well say, you know, all these things. I was saying it to you, or that the meaning of words and the use of concepts and principles and theories, you know, is. I mean, we are people have a lot of imagination, right? And they can use concepts, you know, through their own benefits and for something which is not always obvious at first. So it's your role, it's our role to kind of encrypt or decrypt, you know, these things and try and see through what is being said.
A great read on the question of vehemence is by Beth Milroy. It's called Who Says Toronto is a Good City? And it's a chapter in a book, and it was an analysis of all of the discourses, the memoirs, the representations that were made by the people who said, do not merge us. And it's exactly where we see, as Hoy mentioned, there's a strange nexus of the right to the city with this in many ways parochial, well-intentioned, but often nefarious agenda.
Okay, great. It's always good to end on a really cool word like codicil, and we can take it up tomorrow. Thank you very much to our presenters and to everyone who's here.